In our breakout and best-selling book, Looking for Angels, A Guide to Understanding and Connecting with Angels, Dr. Scott Guerin and I share how you can communicate with angels, understand signs from the universe and these celestial beings, feel at peace knowing you are always connected to Source, and much more. Get your copy today at lookingforangelsbook.com, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your local bookstore. And now you can even get the audio version narrated by me and Scott through Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. You are listening to A Psychic Story, a podcast that shares behind-the-scenes insights of people who lead supernatural lives among the ordinary. And I'm your host, Nicole Bigley. Join me every other Wednesday as I dispel the myths behind magic and lore. Welcome to A Psychic Story. Everyone, thank you for joining this episode of A Psychic Story. I have a special guest on today, and his name is Phil Goldberg. Very excited to be talking about his latest book, The Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times. And welcome to the show, Phil.
Good to be with you, Nicole.
Well, tell us how you got started in this line of work. Obviously, you're an author, you have multiple books, but You were saying that you could be talking for hours about your spiritual journey. So I always just love to hear from people on how they got started.
I can talk for hours because I'm old now, but it started when I was young, when I was in college back in the 60s, which, as you know, your listeners probably know, even if they weren't born then, they probably heard about things from there. Family and history teachers, perhaps, but it was a very difficult time. It was the most challenging time for society, I think, until the pandemic. And I was part of the generation of seekers that were looking for answers to all the big questions of life and trying to figure out how to live a happy life and a fulfilling life. And none of the conventional answers seemed to apply. And in that mix, several things happened. One, psychedelic drugs were handed out and being used, and I did some of that. And they were, well, I can't say they were the first glimpse into some kind of transcendental experience or some sense of not of that I am. There's more going on here that meets the eye and dimensions of reality that we don't perceive through our senses. And that I, and therefore everybody, is, as Walt Whitman put it, I'm not contained between my hat and my boots, that there is something of a spiritual nature. I had glimpses of that as an adolescent, and I didn't know what to make of it, and I just sort of discarded it. But combination of drugs, and I was not a heavy user, just a few experiments, and then exposure to the spiritual traditions that came to us from the East. That was a very big part of what we think of as the 1960s counterculture. And then when the Beatles started practicing transcendental meditation and went to India, that was a watershed moment. I was reading a lot of Eastern philosophy. There were leading figures who many of us looked up to, who legitimized the wisdom that came to us from the East that we think of as Hinduism and Buddhism, but it's really the sort of mystical, experiential teachings of those traditions, and then others, even Western traditions, started to percolate, and people I respected that. And so I read a lot. And all that just turned me to the East. I was, you know, a secular atheist, political activist, discontented young man. And then the teachings of the East made allowed me to make sense of my own experiences that I had. And they just held, they just seemed very reasonable way of looking at the universe and the nature of existence and who we are. And they offered practical methods, principally meditation, to unfold these realities in our inner lives. And I just dove in completely. I ended up dropping out of graduate school and going on meditation retreats all the time, and then becoming a teacher of transcendental meditation, which is how I spent much of the 70s. And then at a certain point, I said, well, I always dreamed of being a writer, and it's the only thing I know how to do. So let me give it a shot. And I did. And so most of my working life has been as a writer, but I also, you know, have done a lot of teaching and leading of workshops and lecturing, especially the last 10 years, because at a certain point, those two passions in my life, spirituality, and in that context, the meeting of East and West, my spiritual home always felt like India. And bringing the teachings of India into the West and it has been an important part of my life. And at a certain point, that aspect of my life, the spiritual sort of teacher and proponent, coincided with the aspect of my life of being a writer. And I was able to write about those things. And so I published a book called American Veda in 2010. That's the history of how teachings from India came to America and transformed spirituality here. And I followed that up with a biography of Yogananda, great teacher and author of Autobiography of a Yogi. And, you know, all my blogs and my lectures and everything else was on those subjects. And then Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times happened to come out during the craziest of times. And so here we are. That's the short version, Nicole.
All right. Well, you mentioned glimpses, that you had gotten some of these glimpses of the spirituality or the transcendental energy. What did that look like when you were younger for people that might be experiencing it and not necessarily be able to recognize what they're going through?
I know people who have had spectacular experiences and had them as children. I do. I have a podcast called Spirit Matters. And I always begin, as you did, by asking the guest about their spiritual journey and what brought them to their work. And very often you hear spectacular experiences that people had, what we would think of as psychic experiences. I'm not given to spectacular experiences. But I do recall times when I was young, laying in bed at night and having a sense that there's something more going on, just an intuition, a sense. Then there were times as I got older where I knew things and I couldn't explain how I knew them. And, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it or anything, but they were like, you know, scratch your head. How did I know that? And it turned out to be true. And looking back, I see them as more meaningful than they actually were to me at that time. But when it happens a number of times, and then you reach a point where you're seriously seeking, like I did in the 60s, when things like that happen, you take notice. What Jung called synchronicity, synchronous moments, and then those transcendent moments of like, part of me watching myself and watching myself speak and watching myself walk and realizing I'm not just my body, I'm not just my mind. There's a part of me that's separate from that, that observes that. And then that's where the teachings of the East came in, because it was all explained there. There, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads, there's words for it, Sanskrit words for this experience of witnessing and the sense of a self that is bigger than the personality and the body and how that's connected. That's what the whole philosophy of yoga is about, the unification of those aspects of life. And so I turned in that direction, in part because all that wisdom made sense to me, but it made sense because I'd had those experiences. And the experiences confirmed what was being given to me. When one of the things that appealed to me about the teachings of the East was nobody said you have to believe in something to be, you know, if you don't believe in this, you'll go to hell. If you believe in it, you'll be saved. It was never about believing or just taking anything on faith or authority. It was all about this is how the wise ones have seen the world. And if you look into it on your own, you can see if it's true or not. And I liked that, the spirit of that. And as time went on, things were verified. And that's essentially the kind of thing that happened.
Yeah, you were saying that in the 60s, you definitely were a generation of seekers, for sure, because in the 60s, there weren't a lot of metaphysical spiritual books in the United States or in North America. And I guess looking towards the East and those practices and how it really was embodied in the culture really probably helped not just you, but direct or set the foundation for us here, right?
Yes, that's what I wrote about that a lot in American Veda. There was a lot that went on going back, you know, as far as the early 19th century, but there were trickles of it. And then the explosion of it in the 60s, because of the way the counterculture evolved, the access to drugs, but also communications and technologies had changed. So teachers were able to come here from the East. There was a parade of fabulous gurus who attracted big followings. Prior to the 60s, there were only a few. And then people could get on a plane and go to India or something, you know, and go to an ashram, or, you know. So, and then, as you said, there weren't as many resources, but there were a lot of books, not like now. I mean, I remember first hearing about the Bhagavad Gita, and I said, well, I got to go find a copy. I was in New York City, and I couldn't find a copy of the Bhagavad Gita. Then I found out about Weiser's Metaphysical Bookstore in Lower Manhattan, which was a legendary place. And there were shelves and shelves of all these metaphysical books about Eastern philosophy and Western metaphysics and all this stuff. And there I found a copy of the Bhagavad Gita. Well, now you can go online and have, you know, you can buy 30 different translations of it in a click of a mouse and maybe even read them online. And so things are very different now. But we had more access in the late 60s and 70s than people did in the 1930s and 40s, that's for sure, and you know, earlier.
And then there was like a dip of, from what I was born in the late 70s. So when I even started to read books on the spiritual and the metaphysical side, they were more prominent, but it was harder to really get to them as much. Even like you mentioned today, like you can get an audio book, you can listen to podcasts. There's a lot more resources. But then there was like a dip of, I feel like it kind of paused a little bit where I don't want to say people weren't transcending. There was people, we were still shifting, but there's been a break. And now I feel that there's been an infusion even more so, and probably a lot of it brought on by the pandemic and by the universe and by your higher consciousness.
Yeah, you may be right. In my research and my memory, what happened after the period from like 1967 or so until 1976 or so, the practices of meditation and yoga, the popularity of Buddhist practices, of the gurus who came from India, the yogis, that peaked at a certain point. But what happened was it went mainstream. It went from being something young people like me and hippies and all avant-garde musicians and beat poets were interested in. What happened by the mid-70s was it became mainstream, and ordinary people started to be interested in these methodologies because scientific research had been done on them. And the scientific research on meditation especially made these methods acceptable to medical doctors, psychotherapists, and people like that. And so when something gets mainstream, it's no longer front page news. It's no longer something that attracts a lot of attention. It's like in the 70s when a new guru came, it was front page news and people would come. And now gurus come and go and no one, you don't see any mention of it in the newspaper. It just, and now, you know, my healthcare provider sends me notes that I, you know, they have yoga classes and meditation is good for stress reduction. And so it became part of the mainstream. That said, I think you're right that the pandemic, what I've learned interviewing other people and doing my own, you know, classes online and all that, is the pandemic for two reasons. One, there was a lot of fear and anxiety. So during times like that, people turned to anything that might help them. And there was also a lot of uncertainty and confusion. Why is this happening? What is this all about? That leads people to think about the meaning of life and what is there something, some forces at play that are not obvious. And people who were lucky enough to be able to feed themselves and were not in danger of becoming homeless, who are not dying of COVID or, you know, working on the front lines of healthcare, people who suddenly had time on their hands, even if it was difficult, those people, many of them were looking and starting to ask the questions of life and starting to explore and finding resources online. Your podcast, my podcast, Oprah, you know, everybody was trying to provide whatever wisdom they could. And so people availed themselves of it and started questioning how they live their lives and the usual habits. And many people said, you know what? I'm going to structure my life differently when the pandemic ends. Maybe I won't go to work every day. I'll work at home. I'll have time to meditate. I'll have time to read. I'll have time to take walks in the woods and do the things that nurture my soul. I'll have time to explore areas of life that I told myself I didn't have time for before. Well, I'm going to make time for them now. If that's one of the good things that comes out of the pandemic, that it accelerates a kind of spiritual revolution that I've seen happening for 40 or 50 years now, but maybe it will catalyze another boost in the right direction, then, you know, there will be some good.
To get us a little bit faster on, like, I love how you said that spiritual boost of the next wave of that spiritual evolution and what that would look like.
And I'm not one to make predictions. So I don't know if that will happen, but I see that the possibility is very real if people take advantage of it and don't just go back to life as it was before. There's a real possibility of that. There's a lot of people awakening to a new, deeper, more spiritual way of living. And if they continue in that direction, it's like I talked about my generation in the 60s. Some people kept it up. You know, people like me. People like me and many of my friends, it transformed our lives and we stayed with it. Some people, it was a passing phenomenon and they went back to, you know, whatever, making money or, you know, different priorities. But enough of us did, so things kept moving in a different direction. And you see that reflected in scientific surveys of how people understand spirituality and practice spirituality, their attitudes toward religion. So 2, 3, 4 years from now, we'll get real evidence whether there was, you know, the pandemic really catalyzed something further.
And you say something important, which is, regardless of a prediction, I want to call it a prediction on my end, but what I see is hopefully most people have taken the opportunity of being given this gift in the sense that if you intend to live your life differently or in a different way and manner, it doesn't have to be a major thing. But I think for people that have gravitated to read your books, to listen to your podcast, to maybe listen to this podcast, they're being drawn to something to find that larger meaning, and how they can implement tools into and embody that kind of lifestyle, that mindset, which I think is a great segue to your book on the spiritual practice for crazy times. So how did you get the idea, and when did you start working on it? And then let's dive in a little bit more deeper to share some tools with people and the tips.
Okay. Well, the book actually came out in the middle of the pandemic, and everybody congratulated me for my timing. But of course, you know, when I conceived of the book, it was maybe the spring, sometime around the middle of 2019. And I was doing the very final editing when the lockdown happened, you know, last year. And I thought, my God, when I had the idea, it was because times were crazy. People, you know, it's hard for us to remember, but in, you know, 2019 in the spring and, you know, that time of year, there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of anger and a lot of fear and a lot of stuff going on, largely, you know, and it had been going on through the whole Trump era, really, you know, the divisions in society, things were crazy. And people are having a hard time about it. And I thought, so I had the idea to do this book. And then, you know, the pandemic hit, and I thought, my God, who could have possibly conceived how crazy it would really get? And we thought, should we make changes in the book now? It was the last minute. We couldn't have done much. But I read it, and I said, no, you know, I'm just going to add one paragraph saying, you know, now in the introduction, because everything in it would apply anytime life is crazy for you. Collective craziness is one thing, but, you know, things will normalize and people will go back to ordinary life. But in anyone's life at any time, things can get nuts. Things can get difficult. We have, you know, we're human beings. We're going to suffer setbacks. We're going to have losses. We're going to have defeats. People will get unhealthy. They'll get sick. Loved ones will die. People will betray us. We'll lose our jobs. I mean, things can get crazy at any time. And so the tools in the book and the perspective in the book, I realized, would apply at any time. I just got lucky that the book came out when the words crazy times had a whole new meaning.
Right. Wow. And I love the first chapter, the title that you have is The Times They Are a Crazy. As you said, crazy times for sure. But give us a little bit of sense of how the book is broken down for people who haven't read it and what they can expect first on the structure of it.
I wanted it to be eminently practical. I've written theoretical books, I've written biographies, I've written, you know, histories, and I've written self-help books, and I wanted this to be easily applied to people's lives. So after the preface and the first chapter, which set the tone for the book and the reason, you know, what the book's about and why it's important and what my point of view is, the rest of the book, there's 9 chapters altogether, is extremely practical. And especially chapters 2 through 8, Chapter 9, the concluding chapter, I talked about our collective responsibility in crazy times, not only take care of ourselves, but to contribute to making the world a better place as a spiritual practice. That is in itself a spiritual practice, but it's a spiritual practice that has benefit beyond ourselves. But chapters 2 through 8 are especially, you know, aligned with the practical application of methodologies that have a proven track record. And I drew from all the spiritual traditions, but especially the ones from the East, because they've maintained these, you know, practical methodologies very well. And I drew from modern science as well, because a lot of research has been done by psychologists and other neurobiologists about dealing with difficulties, how to be resilient, various methodologies for changing the structure of thought and this and that. And a central argument, a central premise of the book that I introduce early on and maintain throughout is that we all have within us what I call in the book a sanctuary of peace and a fortress of strength. And as I say, this is not something you have to create or build or find, like, you know, a building or anything like that. It's who we are. It's what we are. It's our deepest core of our being. It's our essential nature. Our essential nature is eternal, infinite spirit. And that is a place. It's not a place. It's what we are, but we call it place. We call it something. It's of perfect peace and of strength that is imperturbable and can't be diminished by anything going on outside us. And the whole purpose of spiritual life, the main purpose, is to access that sanctuary, connect to it, awaken to its presence within us, and to integrate it into the activities of our mind and our body and our speech so that we behave like spiritual beings in the material world and become not that bad things can never happen, not that loss and grief and all the other negative things of life will go away and disappear. No, we're human. We're living a human life and those things are going to come. But that we can be relatively impervious to it. We can maintain that inner peace and that strength even in the midst of it. There's a line in the Bhagavad Gita that talks about having equanimity, that inner stability and peacefulness in the midst of gain or loss, victory and defeat, pleasure and pain. That all those dualities of life will continue, but you inside can maintain peace. That takes practice and time. And I can tell you, after 50 years of meditating, all you have to do is ask my wife, and she'll tell you that I lose it sometimes, and I'm not always, you know, Mr. Meditator and Mr. Spiritual Teacher and Mr. And I'm the first to acknowledge that because I'm human. But I recover more quickly, and it's not as extreme as it would have been in the past, and at times can get upset and catch myself and watch myself and say, oh, look what's happening in your mind and in your body, and stop. And those are the signs of spiritual progress, or at least some signs of spiritual progress. They come over time. And so I highly recommend and give instructions for deep meditative practice to do on a regular basis, what people in the yoga world call sadhana, the regular spiritual practice. That to me is a critical ingredient. And then I go on in the book to talk about all the other methods we can bring in the midst of life in different times of day, under different circumstances, and to create an inventory or a repertoire. Fill your spiritual pantry with various methods that you can call on when you need certain ingredients at certain times. And there's chapters about that. So that's a long way of saying that's the structure of the book and the basic premise of the book.
You said something that's really powerful, which I've framed it a little differently on the show before, but that we are spiritual beings here having a human experience. So when we keep that in mind, like you were saying about life is always going to throw us these curveballs. It's an up and down moment, and we need to be prepared and have the best tools in our arsenal and be prepared as much as possible for when those down times happen, and then we're back up and everything else. But if we can kind of keep that frame of reference in mind that, yes, we're human and we're going to have these human experiences, but ultimately it's for our spiritual growth. And that mm-hmm. has always helped me, at least. I don't know if for other people, but it just helps me kind of snap out of it a little bit more to put that perspective into the frame.
Yes. And I'll take it a step further, because this is one of the many methods I talk about in the book. When bad things happen, when difficulties arise and challenges come, there's ways to deal with it and ways to frame what's going on so you're looking at it from a higher perspective. And one of those is, as you say, to remember, I'm a spiritual being. I'm here having this human experience, not by chance, but because the universe is structured that way. We become human beings for that purpose, to have these experiences and to spiritualize the material world. And remembering that, we are, our essence is spiritual, and we have these bodies that, you know, sort of rent a body or a vehicle, you know, Hertz rent a body. And we're here to learn and grow. That is what the spirit, the human experience is about and for. And so having that, remembering that, and then taking the next step to say, how does this fit in my curriculum? I always say, you know, we're here on the, you know, the campus of University of Earth, and we matriculate from one grade to another. And if you believe in reincarnation, you know, that's part of the matriculation process. But you don't have to. You could just think of it as this life, if you wish. And we grow and we advance and we move to the next course and the next lessons. But we all have independent studies, because no two curricula are the same. We all have what we're here to learn. And, you know, the courses arise surprisingly sometime. Oh, here's a test. I didn't know we had a test coming up. And here it is. Pop quiz. There you go. And so if you have that perspective, then the next thing you do is say, what is the lesson here? What am I supposed to learn? How do I matriculate? And that requires often some careful thought, some introspection, maybe some guidance from people you trust, your fellow travelers or a spiritual counselor, somebody to sort it out, because we're very prone to fooling ourselves and deriving the easy lesson, when the real lesson we may have to learn may be a little more difficult, or call on you to actually change a little more. It's easy to learn a lesson, but knowing what the right lesson and the maximum lesson to learn in this circumstance, that requires a little, you know, work and a little introspection. Sometimes we get it right, sometimes we get it wrong, sometimes we have to take the course again. And you know you got it wrong when it comes up again.
That's exactly what I was going to bring up next, because I have a lot of people that will ask me, whether they're clients or even just friends and family, like, why am I having this lesson again? Why is it repeating? And I'm thinking, okay, well, you got through it, but that doesn't mean, like what you were just talking about, maybe that you internalized it or were looking at it about, well, why is it coming up and what do I need to take from this? And then I promise you, once you do, sometimes it's as simple as having a click in your mind, like, oh, like you're approaching it a little bit differently, or you're just at least recognizing it and moving on. Some are a little bit easier, some are a little bit harder, but just recognizing it. And then oftentimes that's when that lesson then will stop repeating itself and showing up. But I really love the chapter that you had about changing your mind. And it's going into where we are talking about right now, which is that perception, to reframe things and have more of that, I don't mean to sound cheesy about it, but that attitude of gratitude. So can you walk through a little bit? Because I think that that also helps whether you have a small challenge in life that comes up or obstacle, or you're faced with something huge in your life. It goes back to just being able to perceive it a little bit differently.
Right. And so we've already touched on this. The subtitle for that chapter, Changing Your Mind, is Working with Perception, Framing, and Attitude. And we talked a little bit about reframing something so you look for the lesson to be learned. And there's other ways of reframing. In general, if you think of our ordinary perception as like the equivalent of being on the ground floor of a building and looking out and seeing what's happening, and then saying, well, wait a minute, I want to enlarge my perception because my viewpoint is limited here. So you walk up the steps, you take the elevator, and the higher you go, the bigger the context that you see things in. You can see what's coming up, perhaps, and you could see how things shaped up. You get a broader landscape, a higher perspective. And it's why, you know, if you go to places like Europe, you see old fortresses and castles built on hilltops because you could see more. You could see your enemies coming from, you know, way in advance. You knew what was happening. And there's a reason for that. Not to mention you're more protected from floods and, you know, wild animal, whatever it is. The higher view. Well, that's a metaphor for taking a spiritual perspective, taking a bigger perspective. What's really going on here? When we're caught up in a crisis, something happening in the moment, it's hard to do that. You have to just take care of business. You know, the house is on fire. Get the hose. Take care of it. Later, get the perspective. Why did this happen? What am I to learn here? What am I to do better next time? And part of the spiritual perspective is, depending on how you, your own spirituality, your own spiritual frame of reference. So for somebody, it might be, what is God telling me? Why is God doing this? And for other people, it might be, you know, what is my curriculum here? What am I learning? What is the karma? Can I discern that? Maybe not. Maybe it's too complicated. Maybe there's no way of knowing why this happened. But what am I to learn now? And what am I to do differently so this doesn't happen again in the future? That sounds very practical and not necessarily spiritual, but spirituality is practical. And if you're making your life better, And if you're coming from, what can I do differently to bring more love and kindness and compassion into this situation, as opposed to what can I selfishly get out of this and, you know, take advantage of other people or something, then you're bringing spiritual attributes to the situation as well as a different perspective. So it's a question of how do we reframe that? And then there's also what happens in the moment. You think, you know, you're in a crisis, something's happening and you're afraid, you're angry, you're worried, you have anxiety. Well, is there a way to shift so that the more positive, more useful, more spiritually uplifting kind of thought patterns can be substituted for the negative without, you know, being a phony? Because there's a lot, you know, if you think of, be positive. Sometimes people take that to such an extreme, they don't face reality. You can be realistic and then also say, okay, this is the situation. But rather than be afraid, I'll shift it to, this is the situation. What can I do to make it better? And that's a shift in a positive direction that's both practical and real. how can I help, is better than, oh, how awful things are. And I can do whatever I can to make things better in this horrible situation, is better than, oh my God, things are going to be awful. So we can make these shifts with confidence. And you know, that's a spiritual act. It's coming from a higher place. There's, you know, it has even has a name in yoga practice, which I can't remember now. It's a Sanskrit word. But it also in Western psychology, there are, you know, methods of shifting to a different place. But doing it realistically matters, because your subconscious will know whether you're lying or not.
Yeah, the authenticity of it. And in some cases, the fake it till you make it works. Like sometimes you just need to be like, I know where I need to be, but I'm not there yet. So maybe you do it a little bit until you get there. But ultimately, like you're talking about, it's like you can't be lying to yourself, or you put the head in the sand for too long. There's still that movement that you have to be moving towards something, and, you know, making sure that that existence is coming out and manifesting the energy that you want it to.
Yes, and spirituality and denial do not go together well. It's, you know, spirituality requires discernment and realistic perception. There's no conflict between having a rich intuitive life and a deep spiritual perspective, and also being rational and clear-minded and discriminating when that's called for. God has given us all those faculties of mind, so we might as well use them.
What is your, I know they're all important, but what is your favorite chapter in the book?
Oh man, that's like asking a parent who their favorite child is. If I have to say it, the first chapter and the last would be tied, because the first chapter gives the perspective, the preface and the first chapter together gives an overview of a perspective that makes everything else make sense, all the practical methods. And the end is, I think, calling people. I've been an observer and participant in the sort of unconventional world of spirituality for 50 years now. And I've made a lot of mistakes, and I've seen a lot of mistakes made. And one of the mistakes many of us in our idealism made was thinking if we're all just spiritual and we all do our best to help other people increase their spirituality, the world will change for the better all by itself and we will have a new age. I've come to realize that part of being a spiritual person in the world, as opposed to, you know, someone living in a cave or a monastery, is our responsibility as citizens. We have responsibility as parents, as children of parents, as neighbors, as friends, and as citizens. And there was a lot of escapism in the spiritual world. And I think the time are teaching us that we all have to take on some responsibility for making the world a little less crazy, whether it's just being a really thoughtful neighbor and a better parent, or, you know, helping clean up the environment or helping the homeless or whatever it is. Doing something for others, doing something unselfish, not only makes the world a better place, but it elevates your own spirituality, which is why every spiritual tradition, and I've studied them all, they all have as part of what they value, doing service, acts of charity, to one degree or another, because it gets you out of your ego. And it, you know, I once heard a guru say, if you want to be depressed, just think about yourself all the time. Thinking of others, thinking, how can I contribute? How can I help? Connects you to something bigger than yourself. And that's part of spiritual growth. And so the last chapter is about being, how service And being of service helps not only whoever and whatever you're serving, but makes the world a more congenial place for you to grow spiritually. And it helps you grow spiritually because service serves the server as well as the served. I hope that sounds as sensible as it looks on paper.
Well, and I think that especially now with the pandemic and when we've been in our homes for a while, we've been in quarantine, we have been taking care of ourselves as we need to and our family. But in a lot of cases, sometimes giving back to the community, I don't want to say it's gotten lost. I feel like it gives us a sense of being more connected, which is great. But we have lost some of that a little bit giving back when we've been quarantined, I guess. And you can do it virtually, you can do all that other stuff too. But there is a sense of that community that you're talking about that is probably an important reminder for people.
Yes, and I hope when people can get out more and participate and be in with others. And think of it, who have we venerated the most during the pandemic? Those frontline workers. Those, I'll bet all your listeners are a lot kinder to the person bringing the mail, to the person delivering the UPS package, the people keeping public transportation in big cities going, all the, and not to mention the people working in the hospitals, not just the doctors and nurses, but the staff and the people, you know, cleaning up. We have come to realize how important those people are in our lives. And one of my hopes is that people will treat them better, be kinder to them, make sure they're paid well, make sure they're treated with respect. But also, what can we do to alleviate the burden of those people on the front lines, to make things a little better so crazy things don't happen as much? And even during the pandemic, there are ways people have been rising to the occasion, even if they can't go out. Early in the pandemic, the first week or two of lockdown here in Los Angeles, where I live, I got a phone call from a new neighbor who's much younger than I am, young enough to be, you know, my child. And they just wanted to know if we needed anything. And if we, you know, they were ordering food from, you know, to be delivered. Do we need anything? And I thought, I'm not that old. I can do things for myself. But what a thoughtful thing. Yes, it was a reaching out. It was a thoughtful thing to do. And I know people are doing that. And I know people are connecting with family members and friends who they may have lost touch with, because they've come to realize how those people are important, and they may be lonely and they may need something. So I'm going to call. I'm going to text. I'm going to arrange the Zoom family reunion or whatever it is. Those are important acts, and they matter. And people wrote checks because they saw, you know, people losing businesses and losing jobs and being destitute. And if they were in a position to help financially, they, you know, they rose to the occasion, and they got more involved politically in the last presidential campaign and whatever else matters to them about our collective well-being. So those things may come of this and stick, especially with young people who now see that we are connected to everyone else on the planet in ways we didn't imagine. Look what's going on in India. I have deep connections to India. I've led tours to India. We just scheduled another tour, post-pandemic tour for next year. And then suddenly COVID went berserk in India, and it's a terrible, terrible tragedy. Well, I know people who are in India, Americans who are in India now. They're going to come back to America. Who knows what variants of the virus they're going to carry with them? We're all connected. That's why we're sending vaccines to India and to other parts of the world. This connection has, it's not only the virus, it's climate change and everything else. And I hope that the younger generation who has the future in their hands will see this. It's, you don't have to be psychic to know our, that we're connected, but we're connected on a deeper level than the environment and the virus. We're connected psychically. We're connected, you know, on the deepest level of being. And so our thoughts affect people in other continents, and our actions affect each other. And so we have to start behaving like spiritual beings with the best of our attributes.
One of the reasons that this happened was because the younger generations are so glued to the television, to their phone, to we've lost that sense of connectedness. And you may argue, like, if you were in quarantine or whatever, that you haven't necessarily been able to see people as much, but it shows you what you've been missing and maybe what was taken for granted. And to your point, hopefully then that give back, that sense of selflessness is being paid forward for not just the younger generation, but all of us to be a reminder that it's out there and that we should be giving back when we can.
And as soon as you can, everybody, go out and hug people safely.
Have you heard of 22 seconds? Apparently, the medical scientific term is that a lot of times when we hug, we do like a quick hug, but it takes 22 seconds for you to really be connected, to have that, relax our bodies and have that emotion and that energy really sink in.
Fabulous.
So hug for 22 Fabulous. Seconds if you can.
22, those first hugs are going to be great. I hugged somebody other than my wife for the first time since the pandemic hit the other day. And it didn't last more than 3 or 4 seconds. So next time, from now on, 22 seconds is the bottom line.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else before we close that you're feeling led to share with the listeners or that you wanted to cover?
I think you did a great job asking questions. There's so much more in my book and everything, but they can find me at my website, philipgoldberg.com. My podcast is called Spirit Matters Talk. It's online and on YouTube. I'm doing a series now for Unity Online Radio called Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times, just a series of 12, and I'm interviewing very well-known, important spiritual teachers. That's my self-promotion, but I want to remind everybody of what we talked about earlier, that, you know, the sanctuary of peace is within you. Learn to access it. Make it a permanent part of your being.
Yes, everyone, go listen to Phil, and he's a podcaster, man of many talents, author, and many, many books. So, and get the latest one, Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times, and really appreciate you being on the show, Phil.
Thank you, Nicole. I'd love it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to A Psychic Story. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode and join the conversation on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. All episodes are free on your favorite podcast player or at apsychicstory.com. Have a question? Is there a topic you'd like to hear more about? Or have a suggestion for a future guest? Send an email to contact@apsychicstory.com or leave a voicemail message at 1-800-880-1881. We'd love to hear from you, and you may even be featured on a future episode. If you're interested in booking a session with me, you can do that directly on the website. And if you want to hear even more content hosted by yours truly, check out my other show, Supernatural Matters. Reminder that you are automatically entered to win either a free 20-minute intuitive or energy healing session with me if you leave 5 stars along with a positive review. Currently, reviews can be left on Apple, Stitcher, Podchaser, or CastBox podcast players. Don't forget to email contact@apsychicstory.com when you do, because it allows me to get in touch with you if your name is pulled in the drawing. Your name stays in until you win. Special shout out to A Psychic Story new Patreon supporters, including Donna DeFino. Thank you so much for your support. It means that we can continue to provide more free content to everyone. If you want access to episodes earlier and or more audio extras, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/A Psychic Story.